This is Off the Beaten Path, and tonight we're talking to John Keel, author of The Mothman Prophecies, just reprinted by Illuminate Press in Georgia. John, thank you very much for being on the program tonight.
Well, we're glad to be with you, one way or another. Actually, I'm in a place that's surrounded by Democrats at the moment.
Oh, that's right. The convention's there in New York.
They're everywhere.
Mothman Prophecies, for the sake of our listeners, without going into too much detail, is a classic, regarded as a classic work in the ufological community, if there is one. And it details the experiences that you went through in Mount Pleasant, West Virginia. Point Pleasant, West Virginia, in the early 70s?
No, this was in the mid-60s.
Mid-60s, okay.
It happened a long time ago now, 25 years ago. But Point Pleasant is the capital of Mason County down there. It's a small town in on the Ohio River.
And but the original edition of the book didn't come out until the early 70s, is that right?
It took almost 10 years for the book to be published. The book came out around 1975.
Was that because of some deliberate kind of opposition from publishers, or what was happening there?
Well, the New York editors had never heard about some of the things that were in the book, and they didn't care very much. You know, the New York editors here, they only know what they read in the New York Times. And if they didn't see it in the Times, then it doesn't exist for them.
Mm-hmm.
And although this material in the book got nationwide publicity, it didn't get much publicity in New York City itself. So that was a big handicap.
Is that how you first got attracted to the story there? Is just from what you heard in the other papers?
No, I happened to be in West Virginia when the story broke. I was down in West Virginia investigating a winged cat.
A winged cat.
Yeah. There was a famous winged cat down in West Virginia. A young boy had found this cat in the woods, and he decided that it was worthy of public attention, and so he charged 10 cents a look, and all of his neighbors lined up to see this winged cat for 10 cents. And he came to New York and did the Today Show. The cat's name, as I recall, was Thomas. And then one of his neighbors suddenly appeared and said, "That's my cat," and demanded the cat back. And there was a whole big controversy about this winged cat. And it was down in Beckley, West Virginia. And I was in Beckley, West Virginia, when the story in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, broke. And so I went up to Point Pleasant, West Virginia, and talked with the witnesses there and got involved in this thing.
Now, the Point Pleasant experiences all involved a winged man, right? The Mothman.
A winged man, yes. Mm-hmm. This was a group of, it was two young married couples in an automobile driving through an area outside of Point Pleasant that was called the TNT area. It was really a sort of lover's lane kind of thing, an isolated area. It had been used in the Second World War to manufacture high explosives, and of course it had been closed ever since. They were driving through this area, and they suddenly saw this large creature standing next to a building there. And he was larger than a large man, they said, and he had fiercely glowing red eyes. And suddenly he spread wings, and he had a 10-foot wingspan, and he lifted into the air, and he started chasing the automobile. And these teenagers were they were all below 20 years old, so I'll call them teenagers. They were so terrified that they drove as fast as their jalopy would take them to the local police station. Now, you know, it takes quite a lot to get local teenagers to go to the police in any town, and they were terrified, and the police were very impressed by them, by their story. And so the police held a press conference the next day, and the story was carried on all the wire services, and that's how it all began.
Now, was there any other documentation other than the anecdotal
recollections? No, it's all eyewitness testimony. But then after that, other people came forward with similar stories. And finally, I tracked down over 100 witnesses, all of whom had seen this creature. And some of them were very prominent people in the area. One was a local banker, the head of the Chamber of Commerce. Eventually, the wife of one of the deputy sheriffs saw this thing. There were quite a few people saw it. But nobody ever got a picture of it, and I certainly didn't, and I spent a lot of time down there hoping to get a picture at least. I never found any kind of footprints that could be related to it or any other kind of evidence, physical evidence.
And what about the winged cat? Was there actual video of the winged cat on the Today Show?
Unfortunately, the cat shed its wings. The wings fell off. And that ended the controversy. When the wings fell off, then it was just another cat.
Uh-huh.
And so the neighbor said, oh, that's not my cat. I don't want that cat. And so the boy had the cat Thomas, I guess, until it died.
Uh-huh.
And that was the winged cat story,
but the,
which I think I wrote up for a magazine. You remember a magazine called Coronet?
Oh, yes.
Coronet,
I think I wrote it up for Coronet magazine.
The story of Thomas the wingless cat. but the Mothman, appearances of Mothman, of course, was just the beginning of all of the weirdness that happened at Point Pleasant, right?
Yes, it got more and more complicated as time went on. The witnesses to this thing began to have other experiences, UFO-type experiences, interference with their television sets, strange phone calls, a multitude of things like poltergeist manifestations. And it just seemed to grow and grow, whatever this force was. And people began to see UFO-type lights over the TNT area itself. And finally, great crowds of people would gather every night to watch the UFOs go over. And you could almost set your watch by them. And all up and down the Ohio Valley, they were seeing things during that period anyway. See, during the years between 1964 and 1968, there were thousands of UFO sightings all over the country, in fact, all over
mm-hmm.
the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a major UFO wave, which we've never quite understood.
And the mass media was not reporting on these sightings at that time?
The mass media was, it took them a while, but they finally did report on it heavily. And even magazines like Time and Life began to report on it. But it took a while. You know, they normally shun things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And after the things had been going on a year or more, they finally began to notice it. And it was going on in other parts of the world, too. It was going on, we found out years later, in Russia. And the Russians were blaming the evil capitalists. They said it was all a capitalist plot. And it was going on in Africa. Later, Idi Amin, if you remember him,
mm-hmm.
he had his UN ambassador stand up in the UN and demand that the UN do something about the UFOs that were coming around Uganda at that time in Africa.
And what was the UN response?
The UN said, we ain't got no money. other people tried to get the UN to start some kind of investigation, and it never came about. The man who was the head of the UN at that time, U Thant, even made a public statement saying that UFOs were a serious problem around the world.
Uh-huh, and this would be in the late 60s or
this
so.
This was all in the 60s.
Uh-huh.
The 60s was a very interesting time to get involved in this, and we haven't really had anything like it since. We've had sporadic sightings in different parts of the world, but nothing as intense as this. On any given night in the 1960s, you were having sightings in every part of the world the same night.
Is there any particular reason that you attribute that to, planetary arrangement or anything else that was different in the late 60s that is not the same way now?
No, we just don't have a real explanation for it. Various explanations have been offered and tried, but none of them seem to work. You know, one theory was that the flames that shoot out from the sun were causing it. That is, in other words, pieces of the sun were suddenly orbiting the Earth, and that didn't seem to work. The astronomers certainly never picked up on it, never saw anything that would justify it. And we know now, we didn't know it then, but we know now that there was a lot of above ground nuclear testing going on all over the world, especially in China. And that may account for some of it, but not certainly not all of it. There was a lot of heavy nuclear activity in those days.
John, did that mark the beginning of your interest in UFOs, that 60s period?
Oh, no, no. I was interested in them from my childhood on. In the 1940s, I took an interest in it. There was a writer named Charles Fort who wrote some books in the 1920s. He went through all of the old scientific journals of the 1800s, and he found all these peculiar reports. And he did a series of books. The first book was called The Book of the Damned, about things that science excluded. And I read these books when I was about 14, 15 years old. And this was an interest of mine right from the beginning.
So your experience as a writer then before the Point Pleasant experiences was one as a who was interested in Fortean phenomenon and UFOs.
Yes, I was interested in all kinds of Fortean phenomena, not just UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
I was interested in, there are over 2,000 different kinds of Fortean phenomena. UFOs are just one of the 2,000. Of course, the most famous ones are sea serpents, like the famous Loch Ness Monster, the abominable snowman, Bigfoot. Things like that fall into the Fortean category. And then things like frogs falling from the sky and... all kinds of peculiar objects falling from the sky. That's an interesting study in itself. We've had carved stone pillars fall from the sky. We've had cannonballs fall out of a clear sky when there was no cannon nearby to shoot them.
Mm-hmm.
We've had 100-year-old newspapers suddenly drop out of the sky. All kinds of things.
So you had, in Point Pleasant, though, you had at least a half a dozen different anomalies that were going on. Didn't the little gray aliens visit, and in addition to the lights and the Mothmen? And tell us a little bit more about those.
Well, the whole area, we're talking about an area now of maybe 200 miles long. There were UFO sightings almost every night in that area. Then there were all kinds of psychic manifestations. There were people who claimed that UFOs had landed and creatures had gotten out of them. And the descriptions of the creatures were usually, in the 60s, they usually described the creatures as being very human-like. That they weren't short, they weren't tall, they looked pretty much like normal human beings. And there was one man in West Virginia who built up quite a reputation with his claim of having visited with these entities. His name was Woodrow Derenberger.
Mm-hmm.
And every time I saw him, his story got better. And it turned out that he had a girlfriend on the side. He was married. And that when he would see his girlfriend, he would come back and tell his wife that he had been out talking with the space people. And she bought this for a while. But eventually the marriage fell apart. However, there are a lot of people who are believers who will accept almost anything. And they thought Derenberger was really flying to other planets now.
Mm-hmm.
And there were other people who had similar stories at that time.
So you had a difficult time kind of sifting through the actual kind of unexplainable events and everything that kind of goes in their wake and in their periphery, people pretending that they're having extraordinary events but just using it for media purposes, publicity.
Well, people are not that publicity conscious. It's very few people are looking for publicity, especially this kind of publicity, because it's usually negative publicity. Derenberger's farm was overrun by believers. Every night there were people hiding behind every tree on his farm, waiting for the space people to show up. And some of them were armed to the teeth. They were carrying all kinds of guns. And I would not want to be a space person walking on Derenberger's property.
When you went to Point Pleasant, Virginia, John, Had you formulated some particular theory of your own about extraterrestrials that was either supported later by your experiences or not supported by your experiences?
No, the whole extraterrestrial thing is not a viable solution to this. First of all, in the 60s, there was just too much of this activity. If we were going to have visitors from outer space and say they came from another star, we know now that none of our own planets are inhabited in our own solar system. If they came from another star, they would have to travel a great distance. They wouldn't come here with thousands of spaceships, as happened in the 60s. They might come with one vehicle, and it might circle the Earth when everybody might get a look at it, and then it would certainly land in some conspicuous place if it landed at all. But I don't think that they would just come in. These things had a penchant for garbage dumps and gravel pits and places like that. They would hover over garbage dumps, for example. I don't think somebody's going to travel 20 light years to visit a garbage dump on the Earth.
What about the U.S. military? Did you consider that as a source?
Well, I had quite a lot of contact with the U.S. military at that time.
Uh-huh.
I went to the Pentagon a number of times. They simply didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
To sum it all up, they simply didn't care. The thing was a thorn in their side for 30 years, and they wanted to get rid of the whole problem, and they were fed up with dealing with the UFO buffs and the UFO nuts, as they call them. And in the Pentagon, they had one woman who was literally their whole Project Blue Book. Mm-hmm. She answered all the mail that came in, and she handled all of the material. And then they would have various officers. Anybody who happened to be in that office that day would be the officer who would sign the letters and so on. But there was no real project going to study this thing.
So you have no suspicion that the government has collected a lot of information that that they're not letting anybody know about?
No, there was nothing.
Or well, that they
the material they did have didn't amount to a damn. And I went through a lot of their files. It was very easy to do. Well, once you have press credentials, you can do anything in Washington. And also, I had an old friend who was at that time working for the Secretary of the Air Force, and he nosed around for me, and he couldn't find any kind of material at all that was of any real use. We found lots of memos and things, but the memos were all based on the UFO buff material.
Mm-hmm.
That is, they'd get a newsletter, and somebody would write a memo about the newsletter that somebody had sent them.
Yeah. So John, what do you make of, say, a book like Howard Bloom's Out There? Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, it's garbage.
Yeah, you don't think that there's an ongoing investigation in the UFOs by the government?
There are random people in the Pentagon who are interested in this subject, but there is no concentrated effort to do anything about it. You know, so many years have passed now. I used to be able to give you a lot of specific examples. When they finally released a lot of the memos and documents, and they did some years ago, a group of us in New York here all sat down. We thought we could get a book out of it. And all the professional writers who read this material said, there's no book unless you cheat. The only way to do it is to leave out certain documents and, fake it. And so no professional writer ever bothered to put a book together of these documents. Finally, a book did come out, and it was put together by a group of UFO buffs who did leave out all the material they didn't like. And
Which book was this?
It's called Clear Intent.
Fawcett and Greenwood?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the professional writers wouldn't have anything to do with it. And, most of the lawyer who liberated a lot of these books, Peter Gersten, after he handled hundreds and hundreds of these documents, he started out as a big believer. He ended up saying, God, this is all garbage. There's nothing to it. And it's not a real cover-up of any kind. It's just typical government incompetence. You know, I've worked for the government. I've worked inside the government in Washington. And my attitude towards the government is the same as Perot's, except I would be much more severe. If I were president for 24 hours, I'd shut down the government. I'd fire just about everybody. Because in Washington, nothing really gets done on most levels. And
So what did you make of the Point Pleasant experience then? I mean, well, first off, let's try to get a little bit more detail about Point Pleasant. Did all of the weirdness stop after the bridge collapse, or can you tell us
a little
bit?
Well, we didn't mention the bridge collapse.
Yeah, let's mention the bridge collapse.
After this had gone on for about a year, then the bridge that joined West Virginia with Ohio collapsed one afternoon at the peak of rush hour, and some 50 cars were on the bridge and went down, and quite a few people were killed. I give the exact number in the book, and that became a worldwide headlines, the collapse of that bridge, because it was such a terrible disaster. It happened at Christmas time, a week before Christmas, and after the collapse of the bridge, we had very few Mothman reports from that area. I think maybe in the next 5 years you had 5 reports, whereas before that there had been 100 or more reports. And we did get reports a few years later from Texas, but that was a whole different story.
It did not compare in the quantity of incidents?
No, it was it started with a group of school teachers in Texas in a car. They saw a huge winged creature that they swore was a pterodactyl, an ancient pterodactyl, came down over the road. And this doesn't surprise us 14s because people even see dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm.
We have quite a few dinosaur reports over the years, including some from Texas and Iowa. People will see a huge monster that looks like an ancient dinosaur. And the dinosaurs will even leave dinosaur footprints. And the police will turn out with helicopters and bloodhounds. They'll think, my God, we've got a dinosaur on our hands. And they'll search the whole area, and they won't be able to find a thing. Also, has happened in France and Spain. And we have no explanation for these things at all.
And why you seem to dismiss the idea that it's just imaginative fantasy? You seem, even though there is no, doesn't seem to be any solid proof for a lot of this phenomenon, you still seem to think that, you know, if it was reported, it was real.
Well, we've examined those aspects a lot. I've studied psychology in the Army. I studied psychological warfare. I was a propaganda writer in the Army. And I know quite a bit about psychology, and certainly I know a lot about these people in West Virginia and other areas. And they're usually not seeking attention, and they're certainly not the kind of people who have that kind of imagination that they would make something up. As I say, most of them are often very sorry afterwards that they even said anything to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something you hear a lot, that they regret that they didn't mention it to anybody.
So what is your theory then in regards to exactly what is happening there?
I don't deal with theories.
Uh-huh.
I'm not a theorist. I've had a lifetime background in journalism and professional writing. And I really don't have any major theories about any of this. I just find that none of the theories that have been put forth work on any of these things. The extraterrestrial theory does not work at all when you study all of the aspects of the UFO phenomenon. Just simply doesn't work. We're dealing with manifestations that have been reported throughout the centuries, not just in modern times. There is a lot to be said for the fact that it all began with a man called Ray Palmer in the 1940s.
This is the man who invented flying saucers.
He sort of planted the whole idea of spaceships and extraterrestrials. And then once you plant an idea like that, it sort of grows. It takes on a life of its own and grows and grows.
And was he taking that concept, borrowing that concept from some 18th century folklore? Or?
No, it all began with a man named Richard Shaver, who was a would-be writer. Ray Palmer was an editor of a magazine called Amazing Stories, a pulp magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And Richard Shaver went to Ray Palmer with this horrendous manuscript, and Ray Palmer published it. And now Richard Shaver had a history of being in and out of mental hospitals. He was a paranoid schizophrenic. And he came up with a lot of ideas about how there were people living in caves under the ground who were controlling the human race through ray guns of sorts. And his stories were about these rays, and they used flying saucers to get around in. And there were a lot of people out there who said, yeah, somebody's been pointing a ray at me. That's what's causing all my problems. And so very quickly, Amazing Stories circulation zoomed, and everybody was reading these terrible stories. I mean, these stories were really, even though science fiction in those days was pretty bad, these stories were really rotten. And just recently, I tried to reread some of them, and they're really, really bad. And you wonder that anybody took them seriously. And they did take them very seriously. And Ray Palmer realized he had something good on it, profitable on his hands, and so he started getting other writers to write equally bad stories about crashed spaceships and things like that. So by 1947, there was a whole cult of people who had been reading Amazing Stories. And Ray Palmer in 1946, in an editorial in April of 1946, Ray Palmer did an editorial saying all of the governments of the world know that we're being visited by spaceships, and they're keeping it a secret from the public.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is just what the people, the crackpot element wanted to hear. So in 1947, when Kenneth Arnold saw something over Mount Rainier, it had already been set up. So there was a large group of people already believing in this stuff. And Kenneth Arnold, when he reported what he had seen, Ray Palmer then changed all of his description. And so the UFO literature to this day prints a false description of what Kenneth Arnold saw. And if you go and read Kenneth Arnold's own account of it, you'll see he saw lights. And he saw them from a great distance, from 50 miles away. And Ray Palmer turned these into metallic spaceships and made a whole big thing out of it.
Uh-huh.
And so it was Ray Palmer who really set the whole thing up. And Ray Palmer continued with this up until his death in 1977. For the first 20 years, from the 40s up until the mid-60s, Ray Palmer dominated the UFO field. He put out a magazine called Flying Saucers, which was on all the newsstands. Its circulation was very small. The biggest circulation it ever had was 12,000 copies. And he promoted all of this. And that's why the Air Force, at one point, Captain Edward Ruppelt, said Ray Palmer was the man who invented flying saucers, and he was right.
And so where does the work of someone like H.G. Wells lie in the context of Palmer's writing?
Well, H.G. Wells, as a very young man, was in a hospital in England in the 1890s.
Mm-hmm.
And he was sick in the hospital with, I forget now what he had, his appendix out or something. And at that time, people in the United States were seeing these lights in the sky, and they thought they were dirigibles. And H.G. Wells saw these dirigible stories, and he wrote a book called The War of the Worlds, which was about things coming from outer space.
Mm-hmm.
And landing here. It became a very popular, as you know, a very popular
right.
story. And that was the beginning. It was the clippings about our dirigible sightings of the 1800s. Now, we have since gone through every newspaper in the country, almost in the world, looking at these sightings, and the majority of these sightings were all of lights. They were not of material objects. And when material objects are described in these clippings, it turns out to be a newspaper hoax of one kind or another. And the newspapers in those days did a lot of hoaxing.
Yeah, John, on this, in a similar vein, I understand that your belief about the Roswell crash, the flying saucer crash in New Mexico, supposed crash in 1947, is a balloon bomb. Do you still hold to that? Japanese balloon bomb theory?
Yeah, there's no reason not to, because if you read the descriptions of the witnesses of that time and then read about the Japanese Fugo balloons, they were called, you see that the Roswell witnesses are describing exactly what the Fugo balloons look like. There's no difference. Now that everybody has decided it was a flying saucer, they're all busy rewriting it. And they've dropped anything that even resembles a description of the Fugo balloon. If you read the, you know, there are a number of books that are coming out about that or have come out. The UFO buffs do this constantly anyway. They just rewrite everything until it suits their particular, whatever they're promoting, just as Ray Palmer did.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit then about the UFO buffs. Have you seen this kind of subculture grow in the last 30 years, really? How has it changed since your original experiences?
Well, it really hasn't grown, first of all. Here in the United States, there are about 50 people who are really the promoters of this. Aside from these 50 people, there are about 2,000 people who are hardcore believers who buy the newsletters and the booklets that these people put out. But people think there are millions of UFO buffs out there. There aren't. There are only a handful. There are about 50 people doing all of the, and of these 50 people who are writing books about Roswell and so on, none of them have ever seen anything. Forget about UFOs. They've never even seen a light in the sky when you talk to them. They're just hardcore believers. So, and also they love to go on radio and television and talk about these things.
So you're saying the actual size of the UFO community has tapered off, even though, you know, Whitley Strieber has a popular series of books, Bud Hopkins, you see a weekly TV series now called Sightings and Unsolved Mysteries that deal with this. Despite all that kind of media attention, there are fewer people now than ever really into this.
Fewer
kind of
than
thing?
Ever, yes. During the 60s, when we, as I said, between 1964 and 1968, there were literally millions of people interested and involved because everybody was seeing these things. And also, every state had several newsletters that people were putting out, and some of them were very good, very well done. Now there aren't more than four or five publications in the entire country, and they're all done on the same level as the Weekly World News or any of these supermarket tabloids.
Mm-hmm.
There's no journalistic standards at all for them. The newsletters and the publications of the 60s were much different and much better. And then gradually the people who were interested in the 60s dropped out because the subject faded away, the sightings stopped, and nothing seemed to happen. And they lost interest because over the years I've talked to a lot of these people.
Yeah. And so are you saying then that... It sounds to me that a lot of what you're saying is almost debunking, even though you still seem to feel that everything you wrote about in Mothman Prophecies, those were genuine experiences of real people. But for the most part, it seems to me that you're saying is that it's just a lot of smoke and mirrors.
Well, that's the problem. Most of it falls into the category of a lot of religious phenomena, which is a lot of hoopla, and a lot of publicity and very little substance. In religion, for example, and we're seeing this right now worldwide, very small children will have visions of apparitions of female entities. And, of course, they instantly think that it's the Virgin Mary. and everybody will cluster around these children and accompany the children when they go to the area where they see these visions. Nobody else will see the visions, only the children will see them. And yet a tremendous cult will grow up around this. We saw it happen in Yugoslavia. In fact, where they're doing all the fighting right now is an area where there's a woman who has been having a lot of these visions. And just recently there was children in Ecuador had some visions of this type. These go on all the time, and they're always interpreted by adults to be something with which they may not be at all. Well, mm-hmm. we have never done a real psychological study of these children. Find out what conditioning has brought this about.
So are you drawing a comparison there to those kinds of experiences with the ones that you saw in Point Pleasant?
Well, I'm you're trying to put words in my mouth here.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to. What I'm trying to get at is it seems to me that you have perceived that people have had genuine UFO experiences.
Well, what do you mean by a genuine UFO experience?
I have seen something on...
Define a genuine UFO experience.
I guess you got me there.
So, John, maybe what you're saying is for them it seemed genuine, but there was no way to document it in a physical... environment.
People have paranormal experiences all the time, on all levels. There are angel experiences by the thousands every year. People have encounters with angels. There's a vast literature on it. If you believe in angels, it's wonderful. And some of these stories are very impressive and very convincing. I don't know if you've talked with any of the angel authors, but it's a whole study, the study of angels. Now, if I talked with people who had been seeing angels, I would record whatever they said about their experience, but that doesn't mean I believe or disbelieve in their angel experience. I'm just recording it. It's impossible to interpret, to find an explanation for some of these angel experiences.
Maybe it comes down to what Robert Anton Wilson says about reality is what you make it.
Well, there's a whole scientific area now. There are many books on reality coming out. And the scientists are beginning to question the nature of reality. And that's a whole different show. There are a lot of recent books on that. We're probably... Our version of reality is probably as wrong as an ant's version of their reality is wrong. The ant can only perceive things immediately around it, and then it perceives it in a wrong way.
And human beings are really in that same predicament.
Well, we have no sensory equipment at all.
Uh-huh.
Our eyes are very limited in what they can see, and our hearing is also very limited, and many animals have better hearing than we do. An eagle certainly has better eyesight. Our perceptions are very wrong in many ways. So what we've been seeing basically in the UFO thing are lights, brilliant lights. I know of three cases where people were permanently blinded by these lights. These lights are like looking into an arc light. And in fact, in the 60s, the biggest bestseller on UFOs in the 60s was a book called Flying Saucers, Serious Business by Frank Edwards. And on the jacket of that book, there was a warning saying these things can be very dangerous. And we already knew that in the 60s. We have many cases of people dying immediately after seeing a UFO, usually from radiation sickness, from forms of cancer and leukemia, which were stimulated to the point where they die in 4 days after their UFO experience. And whatever these things are, they're putting out an enormous amount of radiation. And I don't think a simple metallic spacecraft would do that, would be giving off such powerful radiation.
Uh-huh. So, again, not to put words in your mouth, John, but what you're saying then is your job, you feel, is to report these things as people talk about them and report on them, but you're not going to theorize.
I wrote a book in the 60s. It came out in 1970 called Operation Trojan Horse, which was a summary of my findings and all this. And the book was published by a big publisher, major publisher, G.P. Putnam's, and it sold
very poorly because the UFO wave had ended and the market had been saturated with UFO books of all kinds. And the book is largely unread. Nobody has ever seen it. And this book sort of explains all of this and explains my position on it all.
Ron Bond, or the Illuminate Press, who have published Mothman Prophecies, do they have any plans to come out with Trojan Horse?
Yeah, he's talking with coming out with it, but
Although the book didn't sell anything, you find people talk about it, and most modern UFO books mention it, and yet nobody's ever seen it, nobody's ever read it. When I go to UFO conventions, I only go to about one a year. But when I go to them, people bring books up for me to sign. They never have a copy of that book. It sold so few copies. I never got a penny in royalties from it. And the book took a long time to put together.
Well, it would be good if Ron would bring that back out then. That would probably be a lot of interest in it.
Yeah, John, could you tell me how we're talking about Ron Bonds, who runs a publishing company called Illuminate Press in Avondale Estates, Georgia. Could you tell me how Ron got interested in Mothman Prophecies?
Well, I think that he had read it years ago, and he knows a bookseller named Bob Girard, who sells UFO books, and Bob Girard had urged him to reprint the Mothman book, and so he decided to do it. But he's reprinted it on a very limited scale.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't saturated the bookstores with it, and it's still hard to find. Mostly, I guess you have to order it by mail. But the subject is. Had attracted so many cranks that there's a lot of controversy there, and when you peel away the controversy, there's nothing left. There's nothing, and this is what irked the Air Force, I think, for so many years, that they were caught up in the middle of it. The UFO buffs were always accusing the Air Force of all sorts of things, you know, and their questions were always, have you stopped beating your wife? And there was no way the Air Force could respond to this.
So the Air Force has been accused not only of some type of cover-up, but actually initiating some surveillance on their own in the form of flying saucers and so forth. That was all part of that same issue, was it not?
Yeah. And then you have to look at the people who are accusing them. Most of the UFO buffs work for the post office. very few of them have any credentials of any kind. They don't... Most of them are not even, you know, high school graduates. They don't do any reading at all. This has always concerned us, especially here in New York and Madison Avenue, that the UFO buffs only read cult literature. They don't read newspapers or magazines. They don't keep up with the current events. They deal largely with rumor and hearsay. And it's very hard to communicate with them.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go to a UFO convention, you'll find that the speakers who have the craziest stories to tell are the ones who draw the biggest audience. And there are speakers out there who have totally insane stories. And I don't mean that they're just weird stories. I mean they're insane. They're classic schizophrenic delusions. And these people draw the biggest crowds.
So speaking of schizophrenic delusions brings us back to Richard Shaver, who was the originator of a lot of this to begin with.
Right. And Ray Palmer published everything that Shaver ever wrote. He published every one of his letters, published all of his little novels and booklets, and sold them to about 2,000, 3,000 people. And there still is a Shaver group out there. They put out a magazine called the Shavertron. and they still correspond with each other. Just recently here in New York, an art gallery here in New York had an exhibit of Richard Shaver's paintings and drew a couple of hundred people. So he, although he's been dead now for 15 or 20 years, there's still a little interest there.
Well, of course, the whole idea of UFOs sells a lot of tabloid pulp fiction. I won't even call it quasi-fiction, but all the supermarkets are stocked with tabloids that have UFO stories of one sort or another. So
yeah, and they try to outdo each other. They have to get wilder and wilder because, you know, they've exploited every possible angle now. Those stories are all fiction. And most of the people who buy these papers realize that, and yet they buy them and read them avidly. There was a chain of these tabloids here in New York that used to hire writers by the day, and they would pay the writers to come up with these wild stories, you know. Bigfoot fathered my son, you know, that kind of story. And they would hand the writer a photograph of somebody like a barber in a white jacket, and they'd make up a story about this barber being a famous scientist who has declared that Bigfoot is really our ancestors or whatever. And they do it week after week, month after month, and the public, for some reason, never gets tired of it.
John, we're coming close to the end of the program here. I did want to get one other side issue in since we're talking about Bigfoot. I noticed you mentioned in Mothman Prophecies this whole notion that the original expeditions for the to look for the abominable snowman in Tibet may have been connected to efforts to get the Dalai Lama out of Tibet.
I mentioned that in Mothman?
As I recall.
Are you familiar with that issue at all, John?
Well, I know that somebody did a book on that, which I think is a very lame book. The CIA claims credit for getting the Dalai Lama out of Tibet. But if you know the story, it's far more interesting than that. The Dalai Lama was being pursued, and a terrible storm came up and stopped his pursuers cold, and he was able to get out because of the storm. I don't think the CIA called down the storm.
They're capable of a lot of things.
Yeah. If I were a Buddhist, I'd take that storm very seriously.
Okay, well, one last question here, John. In the intervening time between the time Mothman Prophecies was first written and published and the time this new edition comes out, and the new edition does have an extra chapter at the end, a kind of a current one. What would you say is the biggest thing you've learned between those two times that would change or the perspective that you would have on the original experiences?
I would never have gotten involved in it. I would have dropped the whole story then and there. I just wouldn't have bothered with it. If I knew then what I know now, I wouldn't have bothered with it. That's I thought then that there was a chance that this thing was a living creature and that I could catch it. And I had everybody helping me, the police and everybody, even the governor of the state of West Virginia at that time. And I thought at that time there was a chance of actually catching this creature. And now I don't believe there was any chance at all. So,
Do you believe the creature existed?
Well, he existed temporarily while the people saw him.
Mm-hmm.
But he did not exist in the way that an eagle exists or a buzzard or something. I don't believe that any of these creatures exist in a permanent condition, whether it's Loch Ness Monster or Bigfoot or any of these creatures. They seem to come and go, and we have no idea where they go, but they go. Maybe they go to Richard Shaver's caves in the center of the earth.
Okay, well, you have been listening to Off the Beaten Path, and we've been speaking with John Keel, author of The Mothman Prophecies, available from Illuminate Press. John, thank you again for being with us. If you could hold the line just a second while we power down, I'll get right back to you.
Okay.
John, have you ever thought about doing any kind of memoirs of your work with the Army and Army research and psychological research? Just kind of a factual book about...
Well, you know, this goes back 40 years, and it would be... kind of boring now.
Uh-huh.
I did an autobiography when I was 27.
Uh-huh.
It's called Jadoo. And
how do you spell that?
J-A-D-O-O.
Uh-huh.
And that certainly sold a lot better than the Mothman Prophecies or Operation Trojan Horse.
Uh-huh.
It,
John? John?
Another era.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay. John, we'd like to send you a copy of the cassette of the show as it's broadcast, after it's broadcast. Should
okay,
we send
fine.
It to you through Ron Bonds, or do you want to give us an address?
Yeah, why don't you send it directly to me? It'll take him forever to... Also,
okay.
He's moving, you know.
Oh, that's right. He did say he bought a house.
God knows things will be in chaos there for the
yeah.
next 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right. Well, listen, thank you again for your time.
Oh,
and
thank you.
This will be broadcast probably by... the end of the month, and we'll send you a copy as soon as we've got a broadcast
okay.
copy.
You'll get a lot of angry mail about it.
Well, that's the best kind.
Okay.
All right, thanks.
Thanks, John.
Bye.
On what the source of this phenomenon might be.